Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, it's been a crazy week for retail. First, on Tuesday, retail stocks were crushed in a massive sell-off after Macy's had a poor earnings call. Then on Wednesday, retailers were suddenly in a robust position, according to the media, as Walmart had another stellar call. Then on Thursday, critics claimed JCPenney was becoming a thrift store after announcing a new partnership. So it's been an up and down week. We'll talk about those last two news items and an interesting study from creditcards.com that suggests U.S. adults still very much using cash for those small purchases. A reminder to like us, rate us, however you find us, whether that be on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. You can also check us out on Instagram and Twitter at Retail Podcast. So as we are contractually obligated to do, anytime Walmart or Amazon is in the news, we begin with them. And so today we begin with Walmart's earnings call this week. We saw rare positive media coverage of retail after this. Despite the fact that retail sales are up on the whole, media is always quick to pounce on the store closures and kind of ignore some of the positive earnings calls, like the ones we've seen from, say, Ollie's Bargain Outlet in the past. But this week was an exception. Wednesday, everyone was aflutter with the earnings surprise for analysts and investors alike through Walmart. Leighton, I got a chance to talk with a Sam's Club representative, actually, the morning the numbers came out. They said they were very impressed that morale at the company was high because a lot of employees looking at this earnings call, seeing what was going on with the company, and they said employees at the company as a whole, very impressed with what was going on, and they see sales going up in both Walmart and Sam's Club.
Yeah, it's really good for them to be able to see both the warehouse club and the conventional Walmart stores doing very well. And we'll also talk about e-commerce and how those sales have impacted the company. But as for those numbers and the specifics therein, you look at Walmart's total revenue trend. It was up 2.9% when accounting for currency over the second quarter last year. So a decent number there. And this was a slight beat, actually, on Bloomberg analyst expectations by about 0.2%. Their U.S. comp sales continued an upward trajectory, outpacing general merchandise and food inflation, coming in at around 2.8%. This was a strong beat on analyst expectations of what they were expecting was a 2.5% increase there. Sam's Club comp sales increased just 1.2% over last year. This is sadly less than inflation, but still beating the 0.8% growth expected by analysts. However, their comps were negatively affected by reduced tobacco sales to the tune of a whopping 300 basis points. Without this trend, Sam's Club comps actually look quite good. And honestly, a lot of people do forget how much tobacco Sam's Club used to sell, used to be a huge driver of revenue for the company. I personally had worked at a Sam's Club in the Midwest, and we sold a ton of tobacco products, a lot to convenience stores, obviously. But if you look at the amount of revenue that tobacco products brought in, even though the margins were razor thin, you look at the sheer amount of sales in proportion to the overall club sales annually, it was a staggering figure. A lot of people were using tobacco products 20 years ago, 10 years ago. A lot of people tend to forget that and how that's going to affect retail overall. And you look at a company like CVS Health, who has really taken the initiative and to stop selling tobacco products to their customers, and how that has affected them actually in a positive way, because they have that positive brand recognition now, and their customers definitely have adjusted with that example. One last thing I will say about Sam's Club. On the last podcast, we had alluded to two things that we regret. And one is that Sam's Club had closed all of their stores in Puerto Rico. I meant to say they have closed some of their stores. I believe they still have 8 clubs running in Puerto Rico. Also, Kmart, they just closed the one location. We had said to the effect that they had closed all of their locations. Kmart, by the way, still has 20 locations in Puerto Rico. I'm looking at a map now, Trent. It is amazing how many Kmart stores are still in Puerto Rico. It is a very interesting dynamic there. There are very popular stores in that particular region. And if you look, Trent, we got an email from a very avid listener. We apologize. They live in Puerto Rico, and they noted that they do, in fact, have Kmarts everywhere throughout that region. But Moving on, back with Walmart, you see that their operating income did decline 2.4% on a constant currency basis, which typically isn't that good, but it was a decline that was expected due to the Flipkart acquisition. And you see, this is still coming up. This is still a thing. That Flipkart integration is very expensive. However, the big news was the extent to which this beat analyst expectations. So that's always what we're looking for. The analyst knew that the Flipkart integration was going to negatively affect this operating income. Adjusted earnings per share came in at $1.27 versus the $1.22 expected, or in other words, a 4% beat. The ever notable e-commerce sales increased a whopping 37% for Walmart over the prior year's quarter, while for Sam's, we finally see substantial e-commerce momentum with their numbers popping 35% over last year. And I've been waiting for this to happen because I feel like they've had the platform built out. Now they just need the customers. And again, some analysts are saying that this isn't enough to keep pace with Amazon if you combine those two very substantial numbers. But those analysts are also seeming to forget that the massive amount of revenue and profitability Walmart has and has been for quite some time extracting from their brick and mortar stores. And to put this in perspective, Amazon, by the way, got national headlines when they opened one brick and mortar store this week. Walmart, let's face it, barely makes regional headlines when they open their new locations. And honestly, I've talked recently about how there's a dynamic playing out amongst the Walmart e-commerce division and how they're constantly looking to innovate on their platforms. In particular, samsclub.com. I recently spoke with an e-commerce programmer. She only works with the e-commerce back end of programming. She said that samsclub.com and Walmart both have seemingly made strides in all of their online platforms over the past few years. She loves looking and comparing all of the different things they're doing to be differentiated and to have a better customer experience. She said they do need a little bit more of a legitimized feel. She says it's not as robust still if you go to samsclub.com or walmart.com, follow through with maybe a third-party transaction where you're buying a product that's not directly from walmart.com. She says there is still improvement to be made, but it is massively better, massively improved over the past few years.
And so some of the notes that took place on the call we wanted to address here, I think the biggest one was the next day delivery option, which is something that we've just recently talked about on the earnings call as something that's going to be rolled out nationwide. That's expanded quickly from their beginnings at the start of the year. 75% of the country's Walmart customers are now covered by this. This is a big jump from some of the delivery platforms that we were seeing rolled out in certain markets for Walmart last year. Also, they rolled out same-day pickup nationwide at Sam's Club. This was launched in the last quarter, also credited in part to that growing sales force at Sam's Club. And in fact, Walmart as a whole, as they were looking at year-long expectations, they actually revised their year-long guidance for Sam's Club same-store sales. They figured it was going to be flat for the full year when this fiscal year started. They've revised that actually to up around 1%, in part because of these e-commerce initiatives that they've got going on. Also, the Sam's Garage app they're pretty bullish on, but because of the increased sales just in the stores themselves. Additionally, Walmart as a company, their effective tax rate is actually projected to come in about a half percentage point lower than their original expectations. That should also help them as they work finances for this year. One other thing that I did want to mention for Walmart, their comp inventory was up 2.5% on the store level and 4.0% on the company level. And ordinarily, like if we were to talk about the retailer we'll discuss next in JCPenney, we'd say that might not be such a great thing. However, Walmart, very happy with their inventory levels. And this is actually something that they had planned on and wanted to see in the quarter. What they're doing is they're endeavoring to kind of mirror their in-store inventory to their e-commerce fulfillment centers, making it more of an omni-channel proposition, a smooth transition, if you will, for customers who might be getting frustrated that they can buy something online but can't buy something in the stores. Also, they're seeing an increase in in-transit inventory, so inventory that's on its way either from a distribution center to a store or from a distributor to a distribution center. So a couple of different things that they're seeing there, but I think the biggest initiative for Walmart, again, we've talked about it over the last several weeks. We talked about it about a month ago in a story that was released suggesting that there might be a little bit of tension between the brick and mortar and the e-commerce side, but still we're seeing signs of Walmart smoothing out that tension, endeavoring to make the store experience the same for customers, whether that be in brick and mortar or in their e-commerce or app shopping centers. So again, a result of that, an increase in those inventory levels. I think the major concern for Walmart going forward is probably going to be the profitability of that e-commerce segment, since suggestions have arisen that suggest that Walmart's not as profitable there as they would like to be. But again, you look at their brick and mortar profitability, it is still stellar. For them to see same store sales come in where they came in, outpacing inflation by that margin. We talk about it time and again. If you're a longtime listener of the podcast, I want to just drive this home. It is difficult for a retailer that is so entrenched like Walmart to see those big same store sales bumps because you're looking at such a large sample size. So when you look at Walmart, you see these same store sales bumps, not only with Sam's Club. And as we mentioned, if you discount tobacco, the sales increases are actually quite robust at Sam's Club, but also at Walmart. That's remarkable. Just like what Dollar General has been doing, you know, such a large retailer, sometimes it's tough to move that needle as much as it would be for someone, say like an Ollie's Bargain Outlet, where you have fewer locations. So for Walmart to be doing this chain-wide is quite remarkable. Even though they're not opening as many stores as what they were 5 to 10 years ago, they're still in the mode of expansion, especially in southern states. You're seeing a lot of expansion, renovation going on in Texas, Florida, and overall, this earnings call this week was yet another reminder of something. Again, we mentioned a lot on the podcast. Walmart is still the gold standard when it comes to U.S. retail. Now, you might not think of it in terms of the retail experience or anything like that being the gold standard, but the bottom line is Walmart's still bringing in a lot of money, more money than any other U.S. retailer, and that includes Amazon by a long shot. So to see an earnings call this robust from the U.S.'s top retailer in terms of revenue, that is a positive sign, not just for Walmart, but for the retail landscape as a whole in the U.S. And speaking of positive signs for the retail landscape as a whole in the U.S., not a lot of those have come from JCPenney. We'll talk about them coming up next. All right, well, JCPenney released earnings this week that beat estimates, but the biggest headline maker was their new partnership. So we'll talk about the earnings call first, and we'll talk about the partnership a little bit. An added aspect of their earnings call this week was that some analysts came out after the call and actually said Sephora's partnership with JCPenney was hurting Sephora's brand image, and it was bad for Sephora as a company, although it might be benefiting JCPenney. And I think we see the regard that JCPenney has been held in by the media. When you look at USA Today's article regarding the earnings call, they used a file photo not of JCPenney at the top of the article, but of a dead Toys R Us store in their story about JCPenney's earnings call. So I think that's a little bit of hyperbole showing through there, about the most sky is falling thing than ever. One thing we need to keep in mind, JCPenney is in a much better position than a company like Sears Holdings was when they declared bankruptcy. Again, they do have positive cash flow around $1.7 billion. And the other thing you're seeing with JCPenney is they actually don't have anything on their revolving line of credit. Now, they've got some long-term debt, certainly, that they've got to deal with. But again, even though they're losing money, JCPenney in a far better financial position than someone like Toys R Us, than someone like Sears Holdings before their individual bankruptcies. And just something to keep in mind as you read these articles about JCPenney perhaps being the next retailer to fall in this terrible retail apocalypse that might not actually be happening. But with this earnings call, JCPenney actually beat analyst expectations, Leighton. Still lost money, as I mentioned, but as with the Macy's earnings call, you'd think death was absolutely imminent for JCPenney if you only got your retail news from the major outlets.
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, you and I both get a lot of news from the major retail outlets. And this was definitely on my timeline as far as social media, as far as doing a basic Google search on the most relevant retail news out there. Because, Trent, I am an investor in JCPenney. I have a massive interest in the company, both from the perspective of this podcast and from the perspective of a longtime shareholding. You look at this company, a lot of potentially good coming out of this call, but this was a call that was maybe worthy of some negativity out there with those calling it a thrift store. But overall, Trent, we do have to look at the numbers. That is how we objectively view a company and its standing as far as being a publicly traded company. Although there was an earnings beat, their comp store sales were maybe the worst we've seen in some time. Down 6% when accounting for the impact of appliances, down 9% including appliances, and their adjusted net loss ended up at 18 cents per share when compared with analyst expectations of 32 cents per share, a huge beat. Interestingly enough, their adjusted earnings per share were actually lower than their actual earnings per share, which we hardly ever see. Their overall loss was more than halved from last year, $48 million versus $101 million a year ago. That's a pretty big relief, and that's a number that stood out to me when I was reading the articles, reading the summary pages from JCPenney's earnings call. And you look here, although same-store sales were not all that good, the company did show improvement in two areas they've been focused on since new CEO Jill Soltau took over in October of last year. First, their inventory was down over last year, a whopping 12.5%, a result of the appliance exit, but also a result of aggressive store-wide clearances akin to those they had around 2 years ago, trying to get rid of stale inventory. Second, and as a partial result of inventory expense being lowered, cost of goods sold was down as a percentage of sales from 66.3% to 63.2%. On the second part, the company credited lower permanent markdowns and a better shrink rate. So as far as moving inventory, it looks like the merchandise they have on the store shelves is actually being sold, along with improved selling margins across all channels, they noted, and the elimination of appliances and furniture. So it looks like, Trent, that the executive decision to eliminate appliances and a lot of their furniture holdings ended up working out for the company. After all, we do have to think about what JCPenney's core competency is, and that is apparel. And even though a lot of people have really not gone the way of JCPenney over the last few years as far as trying to find the newest and best trends out there, we do have to note that Jill Soltau is really understanding of JCPenney's legacy and who their core customer is.
So speaking of that core customer, let's talk about a couple of initiatives that they rolled out this week. One, I think, more in line with their core customer than the other, but first, let's talk about the ThredUp partnership. That was kind of the big news coming out of the earnings call, or really coming out of a separate release this week. Not so much the numbers. Again, people were weirdly critical about the numbers. Stock is still down significantly over the past 2 weeks to about 60 cents at Friday, August 16th's market close. But the company's initiatives with external parties really did take the news. And the most notable of these was a store within a store ThredUp partnership that was announced. Now, as Leighton mentioned, as I mentioned, some pundits were saying that this effectively turns JCPenney into a thrift store where they're reselling used products. But for those who don't know, ThredUp is, and this is according to their website, the world's largest fashion resale marketplace. They have some numbers to back that up. The number of clothing items that they have at any given time, well into the millions, larger than the likes of Poshmark even. They have their own robust distribution network across the U.S., specialize in specifically women's and kids' clothes, which is kind of interesting because their CEO founded the company to get rid of clothes in his wardrobe, and they no longer specialize in men's clothes at all. But they estimate that they get about 40,000 new items from across the U.S., every single day. So that's a little bit about ThredUp. And with that type of volume, it suggests certainly that the market for secondary clothes is a little bit larger than what some might believe. We'll talk about that here in a second. Now, the partnership will be employed through 30 JCPenney stores at first, including markets such as Austin, Nashville, the MDV Metro, or Maryland, DC, and Virginia Metro, Atlanta, and Salt Lake City. And the last seems to be a little bit of an outlier in terms of kind of market size. But again, Salt Lake City, a growing market. We've mentioned it on the podcast before, one of the biggest growing metro areas in the U.S. Macy's, by the way, is worthy to mention. They're attempting a similar pilot in 40 different stores. But at JCPenney, these store within a store concepts will take up about 500 to 1,000 square feet. Additionally, these items will generally be eligible for any JCPenney-based discounts. So if you have a discount card or something along those lines for JCPenney or a coupon, you might be able to use those in-store with these items. And that was something that was actually trumpeted in JCPenney's news release regarding this partnership. So the general idea is that customers will have an opportunity to interact with the clothes in a real-time environment versus ordering online and going through a shipping or appeals process if the item is not as advertised, like what you might see with a company like Poshmark. Now, on the call, JCPenney also revealed the unveiling of what's called the Styling Room, which is a dressing room with a personal styling service. I think of these two partnerships, the ThredUp partnership probably has more runway to growth. I think the Styling Room, while a good idea in theory, you look at who JCPenney's core customer is, and we found out a little bit about this when Ron Johnson kind of plunged the company into harder times a few years ago when he took away those regular discounts there. JCPenney's core customer is one that is searching for those discounts on a regular basis. We know this, again, from the company's own experiences, but that doesn't seem to vibe well with something like a personal styling service that might be better served in a Macy's or a Dillard's or a department store that's maybe a half step above JCPenney in terms of public recognition of their stylishness. But we'll see how the Styling Room goes. As far as the ThredUp move, I feel like it's fashionable, of course, to criticize it as JCPenney becoming a thrift store, JCPenney being analogous to something like a Goodwill. Although we've talked on the show in the past about just how robust thrift store retail really is in the U.S., I feel like that criticism is an uninformed take. When you look at the overall nature of resale, you know, it started with eBay, of course, in the 90s. But lately, you look at companies like ThredUp, like The RealReal, like Poshmark, they all have real momentum among those millennials and those younger than millennials, which are the exact demographics that JCPenney historically, at least over the last 10 to 20 years, have had trouble bringing into the store. You look at JCPenney's target demographic, not necessarily the target demographic, but the demographic they're actually seeing, it's been skewing older and older. And in this case, buying lightly used name brand clothing, shoes, and more has become a very accepted method of shopping for those in the younger age group and even those that aren't in the younger age group. I know my wife, for example, probably 80 to 90% of the shoes, of the jackets, that type of thing that she purchases come from one of these type of websites because it is a little bit less expensive and you can get legitimately quality products from them. There's a fair amount of people out there who actually now make a living by mining Goodwill and like thrift store retailers for quality name brand merchandise and then reselling it on these type of platforms. But I think the number that you look at here is the number that you got from 2018, about 56 million women in the U.S. That's about half of the U.S. female adult population bought secondhand in 2018. That's up over 27% from 2017. So it's one thing to say, well, JCPenney's turning into a thrift store, JCPenney's alienating their core customer, but are they really? It seems like this is a pretty good plan for JCPenney because you have, again, nearly half of U.S. women as of last year buying secondhand. It would not surprise me one bit to see that number increase this year. Doesn't it make sense to make an appeal to those customers to be able to shop at the store within a store and buy this name brand merchandise that would ordinarily cost you a lot more at a lower price while at the same time being able to try that merchandise on or feel it or interact with it in a personal setting? I think this partnership has an opportunity to be a win for JCPenney. Obviously, I'm not going to say that it's a win for JCPenney out and out just immediately, but I think it's got the opportunity to have legs, especially for a company that's trying to involve a younger demographic. And if you bring people into stores for a third-party service or for something else, you're going to see that crossover in terms of merchandise sales. Macy's has seen the same thing with their backstage store within a store. We've actually criticized them because the crossover rate's a lot less. It's about 10 to 20% for those customers coming into regular Macy's stores to shop at the backstage store within a store than it is for some other stores that are bringing in that crossover traffic, let's say Kohl's with some of their Amazon pilots, for example. So I think JCPenney has a real opportunity here to bring customers into the store for the first time or for the first time in a long time and get some of that crossover traffic. This is an opportunity for JCPenney, who is looked at as a retailer that, of course, starts their prices a little bit high and then has these sales, buy one, get one free, or 50% off or 40% off on a regular basis. This is an opportunity for them to get these new customers into stores and say, hey, while you're here buying this name brand merchandise or looking at this name brand merchandise at a discount, we also have this name brand merchandise over here that we're offering at a discount, or we have this magnificent sale going on, and it's at least a shot. Will it work? Well, who knows? But if you even bring in 10 to 20% of customers and get that crossover there, then you're looking at very real revenue growth for JCPenney going forward. And it seems like, you know, we were pretty bullish, honestly, on the appliance rollout. I feel like this particular platform has an opportunity to grow larger than the appliance rollout for JCPenney. And I feel like Jill Soltau has negotiated a bit of a win, just like I feel like Macy's has negotiated a win with their trial as well.
As many of our listeners may know, I recently went down to Medellin, Colombia to a facility called BioAccelerator, where they infused both my knee and ankle with adult active stem cells. And this sounds maybe a little bit crazy to some of you out there, but I was pretty much desperate for new treatment options. I had done physical therapy. I had done a number of newer age treatments for my left knee and my right ankle. Nothing was working. Looked on the internet, found a lot of interesting interviews surrounding this particular company. BioAccelerator ended up being the company that I chose for my stem cell therapy. They're the global leader, let's be honest. They offer the state-of-the-art medical facility and the ability to treat patients with tens of millions of active adult stem cells to help recover from injuries like maybe the ones I had or other major medical complications. BioAccelerator currently offers treatments for a variety of conditions ranging from orthopedic injury, spine and disc injury, chronic pain, and even severe autoimmune disease. BioAccelerator has something for everyone out there. If you're looking to stay in the game and keep yourself feeling youthful, ask about their anti-aging and rejuvenation treatments as well. You will not be disappointed.
And if you or someone you know suffers from a life of pain or complications due to a major medical condition, you can join the likes of UFC Hall of Famer Matt Hughes, Chael Sonnen as well, and Chuck Liddell, and become a BioX man or a BioX woman today. And the web address to check that out is stemcells.bioaccelerator.com/retail podcast. Again, that's stemcells.bioaccelerator.com/retail podcast and tell them Leighton sent you. Well, we continue the Retail Focus podcast with a segment we've had on again, off again in terms of our own retail experiences over the past week. Lately, I've done a bit of traveling for work, and this last week, I visited the southeastern United States, had some great experiences generally in cities like Raleigh and Savannah, went to Atlanta as well, but I wanted to talk a little bit about my visit to some of the retail stores in this region, most notably Harris Teeter. Now, for those that don't know, Harris Teeter was acquired by Kroger a few years ago, and the idea was that Kroger would get a little bit of that name recognition in the South in pockets where they didn't already have it. Now, a lot of the southeastern United States already has some decent name recognition with Kroger. Raleigh, not necessarily one of those cities. So I went to a Harris Teeter store. First of all, much smaller square footprint, despite the fact that this was in a fairly nice neighborhood. It was just north of downtown Raleigh and near kind of the financial center of the city. But this particular Harris Teeter, I thought it was interesting. I'm posting some pictures on our Instagram page as we speak about it. But the shelving in the stores and the tagging on the store shelves had not yet been changed over to Kroger standard store tags. Same thing with the signage within the store. And I'm not talking about the permanent signage that's up on the walls. I'm talking about even the sales signage hadn't been switched over to the typical Kroger format. In the past, when we've seen Kroger take over some of these smaller brands, we usually see them take over the shelf tag system. We usually see them take over the sales system as well. That wasn't the case here. This store remained uniquely Harris Teeter, but one of the interesting things that I found out, I had gotten some merchandise at the store, was planning on purchasing it. I went to the checkout and they asked me for the VIC card, which is something that Harris Teeter store participants use. It's called the Very Important Customer Card. They call it the VIC card there. And I said, well, I don't have one of those, but I do have a Kroger card here. And I presented it to the cashier and she acted like she had never seen it before. In fact, she had almost acted like she had never even heard of Kroger before. She went ahead, scanned the card, and it did work. But I think there's a big gap here in terms of Kroger's takeover of Harris Teeter. And I get if you want to kind of keep the brand where it's at, because it does have a loyal following in those areas of the U.S. But at the same time, in terms of engaging your store employee base, didn't really see that as far as the knowledge of the Kroger and Harris Teeter crossover. This was just one small example, many examples throughout the store. For example, the adoption of more private label products, like the private selection brands for Kroger, that was lacking as well. So I think it really opened my eyes to just how much further Kroger has to go in terms of fully integrating Harris Teeter. And again, it's not about changing the branding of that store. If you want the branding to remain unique, that's great. But why not throw in some benefits that Kroger customers are used to in those Harris Teeter stores, and making sure that customers know that they can take advantage of those Kroger benefits within those Harris Teeter stores. And also, again, educating the store employee base would help a little bit as well. Now, I also went to Savannah. I'll mention this very briefly. Savannah, of course, known as being a city with a lot of history. And I think this was interesting. There are a few pictures of this I'll put on the Instagram page as well. But you have these older historic buildings. But in much of Savannah's downtown, these historic buildings are actually occupied by larger chain stores. So chain stores like The Gap, for example, are in these historic buildings. So you have these historic buildings top to bottom, and yet they're occupied by maybe a Five Guys, or occupied by a Gap or a Banana Republic or another chain type retailer. And I think it was an interesting juxtaposition there. There were not as many local retailers as I expected from Savannah's downtown. And I think that speaks to the fact that a lot of chain retailers looking to get in on areas like this that have that type of tourism community that is coming in, trying to capitalize on those shoppers spending money where otherwise the Gap may be in their hometown where they're traveling from, they might not do. So interesting tactic by those, but it does lend a little bit of a different feel certainly to the city's historic downtown. There's one other thing that I'll mention, and I'm going to bring this up in the future on the podcast, but I did have a visit at a Pier 1 Imports distribution facility, or I guess now Pier 1 distribution facility, because they're in the midst of rebranding. And we'll talk about that the next time we talk about Pier 1 on the podcast, but a lot of interesting takeaways from that as well in terms of adjusting to the omnichannel approach of the company.
We wrap up the news portion of our show with a study from creditcards.com. As we usually do with any type of study like this, we have to begin with the methodology behind the study itself. Creditcards.com is very transparent as to how they arrived at their conclusions. First, preferences were measured for purchases under $10 in value only. Over 2,500 U.S. adults were surveyed from this study, all of which through the YouGov platform between July 17th and July 19th. This may skew the results a little bit, as we're looking at those pretty much with only internet access were able to take this survey. That said, the results themselves have a higher proportion of cash use than would be assumed from regular internet users. This was really mind-blowing to us amongst a lot of other things that stood out with this survey. The main findings revealed that for the survey group, 49% of U.S. adults pay for these small purchases, again, under that $10 price point, using cash. 35% pay with debit cards, and only 16% pay with credit cards. And this is interesting. Among those who owned reward credit cards, so the credit cards that, for instance, give you 1.5% cash back, the numbers were a little bit more even, but still tilted towards cash. Interesting. 43% cash, 31% debit, and 26% credit. Again, that's amongst those who owned rewards credit cards. Perhaps the most mind-blowing thing to us were the reasons given for the use of cash rather than debit or credit cards. And you look here, 40% of rewards credit card holders said that cash or debit cards is actually easier or quicker during a transaction. These people are apparently really set on using cash. And honestly, Trent, I don't see a lot of this firsthand. And maybe we should look at the geographic footprint of which these customers are in, or whoever took the survey, where they live. 24% said they preferred cash or debit over credit card concerns. This is a bit more understandable, but still, why not swipe the credit card and pay for it later and have that cash in hand now? 14% said that stores have minimums for card purchases. And this is the most reasonable response, especially, Trent, you're looking at a very low price point, and typically this transaction may happen at a retailer that does have a minimum for card purchases or a particular fee if you swipe a credit card or a debit card on top of whatever their total purchase amount is. 11%, by the way, said that they have no incentive to use a rewards card. And it's interesting because why would they even have a rewards card in the first place if they don't have an incentive to use it? The study quoted the CEO of Creditful as noting that many people struggle with budgeting, and so they are naturally fearful of credit cards. But it would be easy enough to see any track of card spending on an app and budget to pay it in full every month, but people aren't exactly known for being good with money, especially in terms of week-to-week or month-to-month budgeting. Also, that assumes that the cards carry zero balance in order to not pay interest. So you really do have to keep track of those types of things, Trent. You and I both carry credit cards. We both are credit card fans, not only, as I mentioned, for the cash flow portion of it, because you're having to pay that balance off later, but for the rewards part of it. A lot of people aren't actually taking advantage of all of the different rewards or types of rewards that credit card companies are offering. Even now, with maybe the credit markets being a little bit weird, you still see a ton of very reasonable offers from the likes of Citibank and Chase, with a number of very good cards for different people out there. For those who have rewards cards that carry a balance, obviously the rewards aren't going to outweigh any interest charges that might be incurred. Again, it would behoove the cardholders to pay off that statement balance every time it comes due.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that we kind of see here in the study is that people might be a little bit more hesitant to use those rewards credit cards because they maybe have a balance that they're carrying over on it. So any rewards that they get, maybe, you know, 1% cash back or 2% cash back, isn't going to be enough to outweigh the interest that they're paying on the card itself. But I don't really understand those that say cash or a debit card is easier or quicker. And that's most of the respondents versus the other categories. 40% of rewards credit card holders said that cash or a debit card is easier or quicker. And first of all, with a credit card, that's going to take the same amount of time as a debit card. Anyone who's used cash, and maybe all of their particular purchases come out to a set dollar amount, but let's say your purchase is $4.93, you pay with a $5 bill, you've still got change jangling around in your pocket, you've got to wait there for the cashier to fish out the change. Some cashiers, of course, are quicker than others. I mentioned the cashier at the Harris Teeter. In that particular circumstance, I was actually paying in cash because I wanted to break up a $20 bill in that circumstance, and it took that person about 30 seconds to get my change in order there. So sometimes it does take a longer time with the cash. And not only that, you got to deal with the change, you got to deal with putting the dollar bills back. It just seems to me like using a card might be easier, but I completely get it if you're seeing that interest carry over from one statement to the next. And another thing to note here is that those with a lower credit score aren't going to have access to credit cards of any sort, much less rewards cards. This was borne out in other data from the study suggesting that higher earners were more likely than all other income groups to use credit cards for small purchases. Higher income groups came in at 24% in terms of the likelihood to use credit cards for small purchases. However, still far more likely to use cash 42% of the time. Women, by the way, slightly less likely to use a card on the balance for small purchases than men. It's about 15% for men, likelihood to use a card, and 13% for women. Not a huge difference when you're looking at a sample size of about 2,500, but still just something for retailers to keep in mind going forward. And there were also some pretty interesting numbers regarding contactless or mobile payments, most notably the lack of their use in the U.S. Just 39% of rewards cards holders in the survey have used mobile payments at some point in time. And only 14% of rewards cards holders in the survey have used a contactless card. The fact that this number is not higher when you see these methods of payments used very frequently in Europe is astounding. And I know in the US, we were a little bit later to accept the chip cards, in fact, than most of Europe. Here, again, the contactless cards, same type of deal. And what's more is only 10% of rewards cards holders beyond those who had used one even reported having a contactless card. 24% said they weren't sure if they had one, and 53% said they don't own one. And I feel like this is more than likely a lack of knowing that they own one, since most cards that come out now are contactless, even if they aren't marked as such. I actually have a couple of credit cards, rewards credit cards, that are contactless cards, but you would never know by looking at the card itself. But a lot of times I will simply just tap and go. It's a lot easier than using the chip, and I don't have to insert my card into a particular machine. But it was noted in the article that as far as mobile payments were concerned, there was a fear of maybe them not being secure, or even fears of them, the participants in those plans, losing their phone. That's led to a lower adoption rate on mobile payments. Completely understand that. A lot of us, our phones are our lives, and you want to try and mitigate that impact if you were to misplace your phone or jump into a swimming pool with your phone in your pocket or something along those lines. But contactless cards, it's interesting. It might be a second thought in the US because of a lack of consumer education. But when it comes down to it, as far as we're concerned, it's really odd that a higher proportion of rewards cards owners in particular do not use credit cards even for small purchases. Unless a retailer specifically has a rule restricting use, one would think that people would want to maximize those rewards cards benefits. Even if you have a purchase of, say, $9, saving 2% on that purchase over time is going to add up as long as they pay their balance in full. As Layton alluded to, I probably use credit cards for 90 to 95% of my overall payments. Every credit card I own is a rewards card, but I also understand that you have people like Dave Ramsey going out there, you know, creating YouTube videos where they're cutting up credit cards, saying you should get rid of all your credit cards. I think there are circumstances in which a lot of the American public in particular, they're afraid to own a credit card, either because they don't know that they can pay off the balance in full, or because they're worried that their budgeting might go askew and they won't be able to pay that balance off in full in order to take full advantage of the reward at the end of the month. So I think there are a lot of other dynamics here, socioeconomic dynamics, as well as education-based dynamics, as far as people using the cards. But in terms of what it all means for retailers, Layton, what should retailers take away, or what can they take away from this study?
I think that both retailers and credit card companies alike should really be in the business of promoting their own credit cards. Their credit cards should be used more by customers. You would think, due to the inundation of flyers that people get and banners in retail stores, that everybody had a credit card, or at least most people had a credit card, and that they were actively using them at their merchant of choice. And that is apparently not the case for these smaller purchase amounts. I would love to see larger data pools on maybe purchases of maybe over $100, but regardless, you're seeing that people just still resort to cash in a variety of ways or circumstances. And I think that's a shame because, like you said, Trent, to your point, a lot of people are missing out on the innate rewards that credit cards offer. And I think retailers could definitely benefit. All of those that have partnered with credit card companies, they get a royalty sometimes off of those transaction amounts. Overall, you need to be promoting your store-branded credit cards a little bit more, perhaps. And when I worked in retail, those retail environments, every single one I worked in, they had their own store credit card that they would promote on the weekends during high traffic times. I think that needs to happen a little bit more. I think the general public needs to get a little bit better informed about the benefits of using a credit card for any type of transaction, meaning $10 and below or $10 and above, they all carry very robust rewards, especially now. But to be able to get and understand the time value of money and those reward systems, because there are different mechanisms in place, is a little bit tough. But honestly, Trent, that's not the customer's fault. It's the messaging from the companies, from the retailers and the credit card companies alike. They need to be able to promote it in such a way that's clearer, to where maybe it's not as sexy to list a disclosure page of around 1,300 words to a particular customer in signing up for something. Make things simpler to digest for the average consumer.
In the same report in 2018 had 45% of people using cash for similar purchases, so the year-over-year decline in cash use is just 2%. So the bottom line is cash is still going to be around for a long, long time. And for retailers, you really have to think as to what this means at the point of sale. Back in early 2018, we talked to a maker of cash drawers in the U.S., or a representative of a maker of cash drawers in the U.S., and he said that their demand was as robust as ever, since retailers have an innate fear of going cashless. Some cities are actually passing laws against retailers doing so. But still, that conversation revealed some worries with cash, most notably associate accuracy. This particular company had rolled out a cash drawer that weighs in real time how much cash is in the drawer. So if an associate gets shortchanged or something along that line, they will know immediately that that is going on. No payment method is perfect, so cards have swipe fees for retailers. As Leighton mentioned, this can sometimes be offset by those royalty fees for those in-house credit cards, but cash allows for human error at best and embezzlement or theft at worst. And anyone that's ever worked in a retail environment, particularly on the front end, knows the amount of emphasis that goes into reducing human error, enforcing accuracy, and keeping that embezzlement or theft from happening. And I think, again, anyone in a retail environment has probably experienced that embezzlement or theft happening with an associate around them. And I think that's something that retailers are still cognizant of. Still, the large contingent of people that said cash is more convenient payment method than a credit card, those people you have to look at as a retailer, and you have to say they're not likely to change. They're not likely to change their mindset regarding credit card use. And especially, as I mentioned, with people like Dave Ramsey saying how terrible credit cards are, you have to keep that focus as a retailer on cash and convenience at the point of sale, whatever that means for that particular consumer. So because consumers feel, some of them at least, like cash is more convenient, you have to make sure that that cash is still an option on the front end, whether that be in the form of self-checkouts, whether that be in the form of actual checkouts there. And I think that is certainly driven home by this survey, the lack of adoption of credit and debit cards going forward. You're going to see cash continue to be a major player in the retail marketplace, no matter how much retailers might want things to go cashless so as to reduce human error. And no matter how much we talk, whether it be on this show or you see in the media, about people going towards e-commerce, again, you can only do that if you've got a credit card or a debit card. And there are a lot of people still very uncomfortable with using those in a digital setting.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
We've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus Podcast, a segment where each Leighton and I look ahead at one story we're keeping an eye on over the next week, month, or year. And for this, we begin with Leighton.
My looking ahead is going to be a little bit short this week. I'm looking ahead towards actually something that happened this past week and how it's going to influence Amazon and their Prime Video platform going forward, or their influence on retail promotion in general. Amazon's latest promotion was very, very interesting. So as all of our listeners probably know by now, Prime Video is very substantial. They have a long list of series that are running. In order to promote these, Amazon oftentimes turns to retail because they understand that foot traffic and eyeballs ends up leading to maybe customer interest on different parts of their platform. So in an effort to promote one of their most popular series is Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, they ended up promoting a number of things around where I live now in the Los Angeles area. They had a line of merchandise that was heavily discounted and actually partnered with a Chevron gas station, Trent, to offer 30-cent gas for a day. Here's where things went wrong, and this is why it's my looking ahead, is because the traffic and chaos was so much such that the local police department had to get involved. They had to shut everything down. They had to turn customers away. People were screaming, reportedly. There was actually a CNN business headline that said Amazon promotion causes chaos in the streets. So overall, you're looking at maybe a Prime Video series that is very well received, that has great ratings out there. Maybe, Trent, maybe Amazon could promote its products and series a little bit differently going forward as to not create such chaos. They ended up actually having to promote a tweet, Trent, that said that they have to apologize for the traffic concerns that they caused. They had to thank the police department, and that they said that if you wanted any other discounted merchandise, you can just go to MaiselDay.com for those things. What they were trying to do and trying to convey to the general public is to watch that series, one, but then also to kind of take them back in time. The series is based in 1958 and 1959, so they were trying to replicate the price point of that era. Maybe that's pretty creative if you think about it, but maybe going forward, they should look at different ways of promotion that, again, aren't going to receive such negative PR.
Well, I'm looking ahead this week towards one big thing that's happening throughout the country, and that's that college students are heading back to campus. And there's a constant fight each year amongst retailers to try and capture that college student market share. We see it whether it's coming from brands like Simply Southern or Vineyard Vines. We see it whether it's coming from retailers like Walmart or Target, both of whom are having these large dorm sales throughout their individual companies. So my main thing is I'm looking ahead towards what retailers are using to try and capture that college student market share. For Meijer, which has stores again in Michigan and Illinois and Wisconsin and areas where there are quite a few longstanding universities, they actually hosted shopping celebrations for 21 different colleges across the upper Midwest this week. And these are annual events. They had DJs out there. They had various different contests. There are people writing in shopping carts. If you go to their website, overall, you're looking at 40,000 students having attended these events for Meijer, around 300 to 6,500 freshmen per event. And you talk about capturing that college student market share. Meijer, you can say, certainly got the upper hand. I know Target is certainly a retailer that has the upper hand on a lot of college campuses, and we talked about certain brands doing so as well. But I'm looking ahead towards the next couple of weeks. What are these retailers going to do to try and get those college freshmen to spend money at their stores? Because if you spend money as a college freshman at those particular stores, chances are better than fair that you're going to be going back to that retailer throughout the course of your 4 or 3 or 5 or 6 year college career, whatever that might be. So Meijer rolling out this event, always good PR for them, but also it's got a financial reason behind it. And I'll be anxious to see which other retailers follow suit and which retailers can capture that ever popular 18 to 24 year old demographic. Well, that'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. A reminder, once again, you can check us out on Twitter or Instagram at Retail Podcast. For Layton, I'm Trent, and we'll be back approximately 1 week from now.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.